Well, good afternoon or good evening, depending on where you are in this wacky universe of ours. I'm John St. Germain. Welcome to Crystal Silence League Hour, brought to you, of course, by Lucky Mojo Radio Network. It's great to be back. I'm having some mechanical issues, as some of you may know. Torn and ripped and mangled muscles in my left shoulder. We're getting those repaired. And it's good to be back, although next week I'll be leaving you again for a rebroadcast as I get some follow-up work done on it, and I regret that very much. All this stuff will be fixed, though, and I'll be, once again, your jovial and dependable host. Tonight we have a wonderful episode for you. It's wonderful to me, anyway, because I'm a geek and I like this kind of stuff. Who are you? Who are you? And what are you? What is that exists in your head that talks to you all the time? Well, in my case, there's several people in my head that talk to me all the time, telling me to do all kinds of things. But who is that? And we will be discussing that very topic when we come back. So grab your crystal balls, and that's B-A-W-L-S, crystal ball walls, and do come back in just a minute or so. I'm John St. Germain, broadcasting live from Knoxville, Tennessee, the most open-minded city in the world, of course, and the most open-minded state, Knoxville, Tennessee. I say this tongue-in-cheek. We're just listening and reacting to the news of Indiana signing the Religious Freedom Act, which basically says if we don't like you, we don't have to serve you. We don't like your kind. You don't get service. And I just wonder what's going to happen when people who don't like religious, fundamentalist, racist, bigot assholes decide not to serve them. So the shoe will be on the other foot then, won't it? That's my social commentary for the day. Of course, they're talking about it on Fox News, and so I have a list here in front of me. Do you hear it? The list of everything pertinent that they've said this week on Fox News about it, and I'm going to read that list to you right now. And we're done. Crystal Silence League, of course, was founded in 1917, for those of you who aren't aware of the history, by a gentleman named Mr. Claude Conlon, our founder, who was a magical adept who saw and envisioned a worldwide network of people who received positive affirmation from him. The idea of Crystal Silence League was to provide positive affirmation and prayer for those who needed it, those who were despondent, those in need of prayer. And Claude Conlon was a master sender of positive affirmation, and he would go out every day, three times a day, with his crystal ball and send out these positive thoughts, and a network of people also with crystal balls would receive it. One master sender, thousands of receivers. Of course, when he passed out of this life, the Crystal Silence League passed with him until a few years ago, when magical adepts of the Missionary Independent Spiritual Church refounded it, revived it, reincarnated it on the internet. Now there's a worldwide web of people who both send and receive positive affirmation and prayer. And, of course, you can go on www.crystalsilenceleague.org and post a prayer, and thousands of people will see your prayer and click on it, and you'll receive a positive affirmation via email that people are thinking about you and praying for you. Furthermore, the pastors of the Crystal Silence League, of whom I am one, print these prayers out and put them on our crystal ball altars and pray for you daily. And every day the pastors, of whom I am one, go out once a day, sometimes several times a day, and as our founder, Mr. Conlon, did, project positive affirmation and prayer for those members of the Crystal Silence League. I often wonder what my neighbors think as they get up to their morning coffee and they see me out in my front yard wearing my white suit, loose linen suit, holding my crystal ball up to the sunrise, praying. I frankly don't care what they think, but I think I send positive thoughts and prayers to them as well. It is our custom, started since show one, that I print several pages of the prayers from the Crystal Silence League website, and we pray for those folks that I print out. And so please join me in wishing these people for whom we will pray. Let us wish that these prayers do come true. I don't identify them by name, but only by prayer ID and sometimes initials. So let's get started, shall we? Our first is prayer ID number 36491 AA, who prays for several things. She needs well-paying gigs and money for housing and phone, and also she needs to sort out some financial things involving taxes to pay off debts, and also to help some poor lost cats, and may they be found. May all these wishes and these needs be granted. Prayer ID number 36490 LP has a lot of debt, not enough money to cover them, and needs forbearance on these debts and also money to pay them. And especially needs the IRS to forgive my debt. Good luck with that, sir, but may the spirits touch their heart and to forgive you those debts. We have prayer ID number 36484. Needs prayer that he and his partner, S, be reunited and all obstacles, especially another party, be removed from their lives. And may all obstacles be removed, and may they be reunited, if it is meant to be. Prayer ID number 36483 CC needs help in a court case, needs help so that they be victorious in their arbitration on the 1st of April. They need strength and wisdom and victory to fight the fraud and betrayal inflicted upon them. May justice prevail. Prayer ID number 36482 JW wants to find true love and wants us to pray that her one true love is guided to her and that they're guided to him. I believe that all people who want true love, your soulmate is looking for you just as you're looking for them. So send it out there. Tell them, I'm looking for you just like you're looking for me. Let us find each other. It works. Prayer ID number 36481 OC prays for abundance, happiness, success, and blessings, and wants life to continue to flow positively and heal the family and men relationships and lift everyone's depression. May their spirits be lifted, and may these conditions continue to improve. Prayer ID number 36480 ML needs good luck, needs a good luck spell recently cast to help. To continue to work. Apparently it's working and needs it to continue to work. Prayer ID number 36479 TD needs more customers for their healthy weight loss tea and coffee business. Needs many customers so that they can reach a very healthy financial level soon. Prayer ID number 36478 JK. He needs healing a wound that he's had for 9 years, and that he can get a job, and he prays this with great sincerity. Prayer ID number 36477, EMN. Prays for the courage and strength to save her relationship with N. Struggling to forget, struggling to forgive. May she find forgiveness. May she find courage and strength to help reconcile this relationship. Prayer ID number 36476, NK, has an interview next Tuesday and wants everyone to pray that and help work behind the scenes for a great interview, great test, positive results, and that she'd be hired. Prayer ID number 36475, RR, needs financial help, needs money for property taxes, and also needs help in a court hearing. May justice be on her side. Prayer ID number 36474, again, RR, needs help enforcing help with their home. Prayer ID number 36473, LN, has problems with people spreading bad gossip and rumors. May their tongues be sealed and may their lies turn against them. Prayer ID number 36472, LM, very sad. She's very disappointed and needs her spirits uplifted and for their friend D to communicate with her and tell her that he is okay. May these channels of communication be open, may all obstacles be removed, and may the situation be healed so that her spirits will be uplifted. Prayer ID number 36471, CD, needs uplifting in spirits. Her husband has apparently lost the will to live and is very depressed and needs relief from a financial and legal disaster and needs peace, needs his pain level to be tolerable, and he needs the ability to enjoy life again. May they be blessed. May their situation improve. May the good spirits look upon them and help relieve this very painful and sad situation. Prayer ID number 36470, KR, has a court trial ahead involving family finances, and may they be relieved of this debt. May judgment be in their favor, and may there be mercy and justice. Prayer ID number 36469, ML, prays for her little brother's health. He has some condition that's unspecified. They pray that there's a simple non-life-threatening reason for the symptoms he's displaying. May he be healed. May he return to full health and enjoy the joys of being a child. We have prayer ID number 36468, LD. Prays that she receive cum laude honors for her undergraduate education and receives her BA degree. May she excel in her scholarship and her academic career. And finally, we need one more. Prayer ID number 36464, KJ. Her husband is forcing her to put up her dogs for adoption. Apparently he married her knowing she had them, but says he doesn't want any pets anymore. She says, please pray to keep her husband from forcing her to put her babies up for adoption. May his heart soften, and may he keep his promises that he made in the marriage. When you take a pet person, you take their animals with them. May his heart soften, and may he keep his promises, and may he accept the dogs into the family as well. May these prayers be granted. May these people be blessed with luck, fortune, love, and prosperity. Amen. Well, here we are again, discussing matters of spirituality and such stuff. As you know, in New Thought, we say change your thinking and you can change the world. But what is it that we're changing when we're changing thought? What is it that we're changing, and who is it changing it? Aren't these interesting questions? We just assume we exist. We assume that there's something in our head. We talk to ourselves. back in the old days, this was an easy question to answer. You know, a long time ago, it's easy to explain. If you said, what is all this inside of me? What's this thing, this mechanism inside that animates us and makes us sentient, makes us aware? It's an easy dummy. It's your soul. You know, it's your soul. Your soul attaches to you when you're, you know, just a little wad of material in your mama's belly, and then it leaves your body when you die, and you know, goes to the afterlife. If you're good, you go to heaven. If you're bad, you go to hell. That's the way my folks pronounced it. My grandma said, "You're gonna go to hell, or hopefully you're gonna go to heaven." So it was an easy answer. It was very easy. And you know, 3,000 years ago, it's funny if you read in the Buddhist literature and literature of the time, they believed everything we believe now. People think everybody believed in reincarnation and things like that, but there were atheists back then. There were annihilationists. They believed when you died, you just disappeared, you know, like a flame going out. You were gone. There were people who believed in every form of afterlife, that you became deities, that you went to heaven, you went to hell. In fact, in Buddhism, there are six heavens and six hells. Varying degrees of, actually, there's six hot hells and six cold hells in Buddhism, and six freezing hells and six burning hells, of various degrees of awfulness and duration. The thing in Buddhism, though, none of that's permanent. You go to hell, you could go there for a minute, you can go there for a kalpa, which is the amount of time it's described. If you were to try to wear a mountain away with a feather, that's a kalpa. How long it takes to wear a mountain away with a feather, that's a kalpa. So that's a long period of time. So you can go to hell for a kalpa or several kalpas, and or for a minute. Depends on the grievousness of your of the fruiting of your karma. So everything that we believe now was believed back then. It's always been believed that, you know, something in you exists apart from the material body, and of course. We have modern theories now, especially with the advent of the computer, presented us with a new model, that of programming, that the brain is a computer that is programming, and that it's the programs that gives us the sensation or the illusion or the function of awareness. And people who believe this are called functionalists. They believe if you ask them what is mind, they'll say mind is brain. They'll say mind is brain. And I'm going to introduce you, if you never heard of this, to what's called the Chinese room argument. And this is a very interesting thing. It's a thought experiment that was presented by a man named John Searle to challenge the claim that it's possible. This came up in... an association with the idea of artificial intelligence, that machines will become intelligent enough to where they'll develop sentience. The machines will become sentient, which is something that I think will never happen. And I don't think machines will ever become sentient. This is John Searle actually came up with an argument that agrees with that. John Searle challenged the claim that it's possible for a computer running a program to have a mind and consciousness in the same sense that people do, simply by virtue of running the right programs. And the experiment is intended to refute the position that machines can have what he calls strong AI, strong artificial intelligence. And the way he stated it was... let me see if I can find it in my notes here. The appropriately programmed computer with the right inputs and outputs would thereby have a mind in exactly the same sense human beings have mind. That's what he set out to disprove. And he says, suppose I'm locked in a room and that I know no Chinese, either written or spoken. Then he supposes that he has a set of rules in English that enable me to correlate one set of symbols with another set of symbols, that is Chinese characters. These rules allow him to respond in written Chinese to questions, also written in Chinese, in such a way that the posers of the questions, who do understand Chinese, are convinced that Searle can actually understand the Chinese conversation, even though he cannot. Do you understand that? He has a set of symbols that he can correlate with an unknown set of symbols in such a way that the people who understand the language thinks he can too, even though he doesn't. And that is the centerpiece of the Chinese Room argument that holds that a program cannot give a computer a mind or understanding or consciousness, regardless of how intelligently it may seem to behave. So this argument is against the positions of functionalism, which hold that the mind may be viewed as an information processing system operating on formal systems. Our friend Nagasiva mentions Gödel, Escher, and Bach, Hofstetler's book. I met Hofstetler, Shiva. He taught at IU, Indiana University in Bloomington, and I went to Bloomington IU a few years ago. When I got my third college degree in literary illustration, and I talked to him, and he's an interesting man. Now, I want to tell you that his Gödel, Escher, Bach is a wonderful book, except the write-up on Zen. He utterly did not get Zen, and we're actually going to talk about that, about Zen. And I was going to mention that Hofstetler, in an otherwise excellent book, wrote one of the worst chapters on Zen I've ever read in my life, but we'll get to that. So the Chinese Room argument holds that a program cannot give a computer a mind. It's not an argument against the goals of AI research, artificial intelligence research, because it doesn't limit the amount of intelligence a machine can display. The argument only applies to digital computers and not machines in general, but it's basically called the hollow shell argument. It's been very, very discussed over the years, and so he begins with the idea that artificial intelligence research has succeeded in constructing a computer that behaves as if it understands Chinese, let's say. It takes Chinese characters as input, and following the instructions of a computer program, produces other Chinese characters, which it presents as output. Now, Searle supposes that this computer performs its task so convincingly that it comfortably passes the Turing test, which basically says it convinces a human Chinese speaker that the program is itself a live Chinese speaker. To all of the questions that the person asks, it makes appropriate responses, such that any Chinese speaker would be convinced that he is talking to another Chinese-speaking human. So the question Searle wanted to answer is this: does the machine literally understand Chinese, or is it merely simulating the ability to understand Chinese? He calls the first position strong AI and the latter weak AI. Now, he goes on to have various scenarios, and he says that there's, in this scenario, that there's no essential difference between the roles of the computer and the roles of a human in this experiment. Each simply follows a program step by step, producing a behavior which is then interpreted as demonstrating intelligent conversation. However, Searle would not be able to understand the conversation. I don't speak a word of Chinese. Therefore, he argues it follows that the computer would not be able to understand the conversation either. So he argues that without understanding or intent, we cannot describe what the machine is doing as thinking, and since it does not think, it doesn't have a mind in anything like the normal sense of the word. Therefore, he concluded that strong AI is false. Interestingly enough, a fellow named Gottfried Leibniz made a similar argument in 1714 before there's even such a thing as AI. And so Leibniz in 1714 said it was difficult to imagine that a mind capable of perception could be constructed using only mechanical processes. Isn't that eerie? Isn't that eerie? So that's just. So what you find when you start thinking about mind is that there are two components of mind that you have to look at very closely. The two components are, one, that which perceives or observes, and that does not have to be sentient. That does not have to be sentient at all. That which perceives or observes, and two, that which is aware. These are two utterly separate components of mind, that which perceives or observes, and that which is aware. Now, you cannot find an easy answer to this. There are several problems with both views. For instance, the soul, there's a problem with that. How does the soul attach to the body? And the problem with functionalism, too, is the question is how does sentience, which is aware, arise out of matter, which is not aware? There's that problem. How do you answer that? And with the idea of a soul, which is the idea that there is an aware and sentient component that's non-material, how does that attach and operate through material media? So these are questions that are very difficult to answer. But here's what we know about mind. It perceives or observes, and then it is aware of what it perceives and observes. So, there was a very wise man who lived 2,500 years ago named Buddha who said that the idea of the existence of soul raises a number of problems. When you start believing in soul, you start worrying about the preservation of the soul, and then you begin to think about creator gods and where the soul began and how where the soul is going to go and the welfare of the soul, and it generates no end of misery. So Buddha denied the idea of a soul that had identity. That was just, he refuted it. That just was not part of, people ask you that, what's Buddha's position on the afterlife and the soul? And Buddha just wouldn't discuss it. He'd say, those are wrong questions. Those are wrong. And he just wouldn't even discuss it. He said, those are imponderables and will cause vexation and madness. So we have that which perceives and observes, that which is aware of what it perceives. So if we have that as a proposition, we have somewhere to begin our investigation. So could we have as two postulates that mind is non-material, but mind is also real? Can we start with that? Mind is non-material, but mind is also real. And if we start with that, then we do have, we do have something to start with. At this point, we start getting into some cool stuff. There's actually an author who examined consciousness from a quantum mechanical point of view, and there's a book I recommend everybody to read. It's called The Physics of Consciousness by Evan Harris Walker. I first read this in the 90s, and there's an updated version of it now, which I've recently been reading again. And it's a wonderful book. It traces Newtonian physics to quantum physics, rather exhaustively, in fact. And then he looks at the physics of consciousness, and he examines many of these same questions. How does mind attach to the brain and operate the brain? Dancing Woolly Masters, that's a good book. That's a good book also. In fact, the author met the chap who wrote Dancing Woolly Masters. I can't remember his name right now. That was a book I read, too. There's Dancing Woolly Masters, and there's also The Tao of Physics that was involved in that whole thing, talking about the metaphysics of quantum physics. Now, there are things in quantum physics that are spooky. For one thing, when an electron moves from one level to the next, say from level A to level B, it does not seem to pass through the space between. There's no path between A and B. It just goes from this is what's called quantum tunneling or electron tunneling or a quantum leap. It'll go from A to B, location A to location B, without traversing the space between. And because of this, Heisenberg said paths are irrelevant. There are no paths. And, in quantum physics, some of you may know that nothing exists in a location until it's observed, at which point it appears in that location. Everything exists in wave in waves, probability waves. It's everywhere until such point as it's measured. And then there's a thing called wave collapse. All the probability waves collapse into a reality when it's observed. So the conclusion that Dr. Walker concludes is that what is an observer but consciousness? So consciousness creates out of probability. Consciousness creates the wave collapse that defines reality. And he makes some very interesting points about this. So we say that changed thinking changes the world. And I'm going to tell you that what I've learned about new thought, I'm going to tell you that I think that new thought is an interesting thing. We change thinking and we change the world. We turn negative thinking into positive thinking. And I want to tell you what I've discovered: courage, determination, love, trust, a whole lot of things like this. These are not states of mind. These are actions. Courage, determination, love, trust. These things that we project outward, these are not states of mind. These are not things that happen in your mind. These are not things that you develop as a attitude. That phrase that motivational speakers use, attitude or gratitude, I hate that. You may hear me critical of motivational speakers, and I hate them. I hate that whole thing. I very strongly dislike motivational speakers and sales trainers and these guys that do branding. I dislike all of them. They're snake oil salesmen in my opinion, and I've known a lot of them. And you know, they in their personal lives they're pretty low functioning. To the man. You know what? Someone said, well, you know, you don't know everybody, but you know, if every $20 bill I was handed was a counterfeit, I'm going to stop taking $20 bills. So until I do meet a highly functioning, moral, upstanding motivational speaker or sales trainer, I'm going to continue saying that they're snake oil salesmen. You know, prove me wrong. You know, prove me wrong. So what I've learned is that this projection work that we do, you're not projecting a feeling or an attitude. These are activities. These are actions. And as a result of these actions, the world does change, and not metaphorically. The world will change around you if you do these actions, if you perform these actions. The world, on a very real level, changes. We have a question. What generates that consciousness? The consciousness is not generated. Consciousness exists since forever. The question would be, what links the consciousness to the material body? That's the question. Let's go further into that. Imagine this, and this is being drawn from both Buddhism and observations that I've gleaned from some other readings. Suppose you look at a brick. You're not really looking at a brick. A brick is a event that occurs in space-time. It's a space-time event that arises out of subatomic events, we can say quantum events, of which we can never fathom. We cannot fathom that brick's existence as it exists in reality. What you're looking at is a picture that your brain makes. You're not looking at the brick. You're looking at a picture that your brain makes. Now, the picture that your brain makes is consciousness. And you are what looks at consciousness. You are what looks at that picture. Can you dig it? You are what looks at consciousness. So when you're looking at the brick, Now you got to follow me very slowly on this, because we're about to cross over into Zennism. When you look at a brick, you're not looking at the brick. You cannot look at the brick, in fact, because what's happening is information gathering by the senses. It's not possible to connect directly to reality. It can't happen. Ears do not hear the sound of a flute. Ears cannot hear C sharp. Ears are picking up sound waves, vibrations in the air, transmitting it to the brain, which is then creating a model. The brain is creating a sound that we interpret as C sharp. When you look at a brick, brain is making a picture. That's consciousness, and that consciousness is what perceives, what observes. Then you are what is aware of that picture. Now, understand that picture is not just the picture of the brick. It's everything you've ever known about a brick. It's all the stuff your brain has stored about that brick, its roughness, its color. If you drop it on your foot, it hurts you. Let's take that away and take a snake. You look at a snake, your brain makes a picture of the snake, and you also know you got feelings now. You go, oh, snake, scary, bite, poison. Your brain makes all of that. Then you are what looks at that snake. So, and here's the next step. You are looking at a picture in your brain of a brick. That's consciousness. The picture is consciousness. That's what's measured when they put probes on your brain and you look at a brick and part of your brain lights up. Now, a functionalist would say that lightning on the brain, that's your mind. That activity in your brain, that's mind. Whereas that is just the picture in your brain. You, awareness, that part of you that's aware of that is you being aware of that picture. So if you are aware of that, here's the next step. You're looking at your own consciousness when you're looking at that picture. You're looking at your own consciousness. So when you're looking at that brick, you're looking at yourself. Not metaphorically, but literally. When you're looking at me, you're looking at yourself. When you're looking at your dog, you're looking at yourself. When you're listening to music, you're listening to yourself. When you're looking at the world, you're looking at yourself. There is no separation between observed and observer. Now, you're starting to hear something familiar. If you've ever read Jiddu Krishnamurti, if you've ever read Buddhism, you're hearing something familiar. And this was arrived at not by a mystic. This was arrived at through relentless logic by a physicist. And he didn't know anything about Buddhism. You're looking at a picture in your brain, which is consciousness. You, which is aware, the part of you that's aware, is a separate component. That's the part which is aware. You're looking at yourself. When you're looking at the brick, you're looking at your own consciousness. There's no separation between you and the object you're observing. So, let's go into Zen. If you understand this, this is the secret of unraveling every Zen koan that's ever baffled you. So, if you've ever read a Zen koan, and they say things like, oh, here's one for you. A monk asked Nansen, is there a teaching no master has ever taught before? Nansen said, yes, there is. What is it? Asked the monk. Nansen said, it is not mind, it is not Buddha, it is not things. There, you can unravel that if you understand this. It's not, because obviously it's not. If everything you look at is you looking at you, there's no the teaching is not the teacher. The student Doko came to a Zen master and said, I'm seeking the truth. In what state of mind should I train myself so to find it? Said the master, there is no mind, so you cannot put it in any state. There's no truth, so you cannot train yourself for it. If there's no mind to train and no truth to find, why do you have these monks gather before you every day to study Zen and train themselves for the study? But I haven't an inch of room here, said the master. So how could the monks gather? I have no tongue. So how could I call them together or teach them? Oh, how can you lie like this, said Doko. If I have no tongue to talk to others, how can I lie to you, asked the master. Then Doko said sadly, I cannot follow you. I cannot understand you. I cannot understand myself, said the master. Now, you'll notice that what the master's doing here is trying to get this knucklehead to understand that there is no I. There is no mind, because mind is looking at mind. There's no truth, because everything is, you can't perceive it directly. You're just perceiving a reflection of moon on the water. It's a reflection. I have no room because there's no I. I have no tongue because there's no I. I can't call them together because I can't teach them. I have no room here. I cannot understand myself. Dig it? Now, this is directly from Guru Lesher Bach, and Hustetler says, if any koan serves to bewilder, this one does, and most likely causing bewilderment is its precise purpose. No, it isn't. It's very clear if you dig it. Its precise purpose, for when one is in a bewildered state, one's mind does begin to operate non-logically to some extent. Only by stepping outside of logic, so the theory goes, can one make this leap to enlightenment. See, he doesn't get it. Hostetler does not get it. He's entirely missed out on Zen. Zen, if there's anything you know about Zen, it's that perception is not dualistic. Unfortunately, we think dualistic. We think there's the brick and there's me. There's a very good one that I really wanted to point out to you that just really nails this in. But you can unravel any Zen koan that's ever baffled you. The moon, the finger pointing at the moon. Oh, here we go. Hyakuyo wished to send a monk to open a new monastery. He told his pupils that whoever answered a question most ably would be appointed. Placing a water vase on the ground, he asked, who can say what this is without calling its name? The chief monk said, no one can call it a wooden shoe. Isan, the cooking monk, tipped over the vase with his foot and went out. Hyakuyo smiled and said, the chief monk loses, and Isan became the master of the new monastery. Now, the chief monk's answer was good, but you see, it's formulaic. You can, if you know Zen, you can generate stuff like that every day. The sound of a leaf falling in the forest, the crack of tile underfoot, the reflection of a heron over the water. You can generate stuff like that every day if you know the formula. But what the cooking monk did, and the cooking monk was the least of the monks. He created a new expression to the Zen of the vase. He saw it as experience. He gave you the experience of the vase. Do you see? And so the master saw the danger of promoting basically the formula. You know, the chief monk knew the formula. He could generate the formula answer, and he was looking for somebody who could show the experience of the vase. So if you understand this non-duality, you see it, non-duality, you are the brick, not metaphorically, but factually. Not metaphorically, but factually. When you look at the brick, you're looking at yourself. When you look at me, you're looking at yourself. When you look at the world, you're looking at yourself. Now, if you can dig this, if you can grok this, congratulations, enlightenment is just around the corner. So, really and truly, when you change your thinking, you're changing the world. What I'm telling you now, can change you forever. Because when I grokked this myself, it changed me forever. I'm going to give you some time to just think about this, and I'm going to play some music while you meditate on this. Well, yes, we're back, and I trust that about 75% of you are now Buddhas. You're now enlightened, and you grok the entire universe. Grok, by the way, was a term very popular when I was a young man. It comes from Robert A. Heinlein's seminal novel, Strange in a Strange Land. The word, as we were told then, meant drink. And it meant drink in the fact that you understand something so thoroughly, you take it within yourself, and it becomes part of you. So I'm going to read you something. The Fina Sutta from Buddhism. On one occasion, the Blessed One was staying among the Ajahans on the banks of the Ganges River. Then he addressed the monks. Monks, suppose that a large glob of foam were floating down the Ganges River, and a man with good eyesight were to see it, observe it, and appropriately examine it. To him, seeing it, observing it, and appropriately examining it would appear empty, void, without substance. For what substance would there be in a glob of foam? In the same way, a monk sees, observes, and appropriately examines any form that is past, future, or present, internal or external, blatant or subtle, common or sublime, far or near. To him, seeing it, observing it, and appropriately examining it, it would appear empty, void, without substance. For what is substance would there be in form? Now suppose that in the autumn, when it's raining in fat, heavy drops, a water bubble were to appear and disappear on the water, and a man with good eyesight were to see it, observe it, and appropriately examine it. To him, seeing it, observing it, and appropriately examining it, it would appear empty, void, without substance. For what substance would there be in a water bubble? In the same way, a monk sees, observes, and appropriately examines any feeling that is past, future, or present, internal or external, blatant or subtle, common or sublime, far or near. To him, seeing it, observing it, and appropriately examining it, it would appear empty, void, without substance. For what substance would there be in feeling? Now suppose that in the last month of the hot season, a mirage were shimmering, and a man with good eyesight were to see it, observe it, and appropriately examine it. To him, seeing it, observing it, and appropriately examining it, it would appear empty, void, without substance. For what substance would there be in a mirage? In the same way, a monk sees, observes, and appropriately examines any perception that is past, future, or present, internal or external, blatant or subtle, common or sublime, far or near. To him, seeing it, observing, appropriately examining it, it would appear empty, void, without substance. For what substance would there be in perception? And he goes on about fabrications. And this is a good one here. Now suppose that a magician or a magician's apprentice were to display a magic trick at a major intersection, and a man with good eyesight were to see it, observe it, and appropriately examine it. To him, seeing it, observing it, and appropriately examining it, it would appear empty, void, without substance. For what substance would there be in a magic trick? In the same way, a monk sees, observes, and appropriately examines any consciousness that is past, future, or present, internal or external, blatant or subtle, common or sublime, far or near. To him, seeing it, observing it, and appropriately examining it, it would appear empty, void, without substance. For what substance would there be in consciousness? Seeing thus the well-instructed disciple of the noble ones grows disenchanted with form, disenchanted with feeling, disenchanted with perception, disenchanted with fabrications or thoughts, disenchanted with consciousness. Disenchanted, he grows dispassionate. Through dispassion, he's released. With release, there's the knowledge released. He discerns that birth is ended, the holy life fulfilled. There's nothing further in the world. Then there's a verse. Form is like a glob of foam, feeling a bubble, perception mirage, fabrications a banana tree, consciousness a magic trick. This has been taught by the kinsmen of the sun. However you observe them, appropriately examine them, they're empty, void, to whoever sees appropriately. Which is a very long way of saying what we have just said, that when you look at a brick, you're looking at the reflection of the moon on the water. Now, we were discussing that there's two components of consciousness, the part that perceives and the part that's aware. I'm going to tell you that 2,500 years ago, this was taught by the Buddha. God, how much time do we have? Just 8 minutes. The part that perceives were called consciousnesses, and there were six of them. And I'll briefly do those. There was the there's eye consciousness, visual consciousness. This is there's three parts to seeing. There's the sense organ, or the sense gate, the sense object, which is what the sense perceives. For instance, with the eye, there's the eye, what the eye sees, and then the eye consciousness, which is the picture in your brain. Ear consciousness, olfactory, nose consciousness, tongue or gustatory consciousness, tactile consciousness, and thought consciousness. Because in Buddhism, mind or mano is considered a sixth sense. Mind senses thought. Mind is not considered the inner core. Mind senses thought. So what mind senses, thoughts are fabrications. Thoughts are called fabrications. They're objects that are sensed by the mind. So these are consciousnesses, and they're broken down into what are called cittas. These are very, very small components of thought. They happen one after the other, bam, 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 bam. And only one consciousness at a time can happen. You have one eye consciousness, one thought consciousness, one ear consciousness, one taste consciousness at a time. But they're so short, they appear to be all simultaneous. Interestingly enough, this has been corroborated by neuroscientists, the way the synapses fire in the brain. You can only have one sensation going at a time, and it happens in something like a hundredth of a second, which I think is very interesting that this was known by people who were masters of meditative absorption. So that's the pictures of the brain, what we're talking about here. These consciousnesses are not aware. These are the parts that pick things up. They create sensation. They create the pictures and the sounds and the sensations in the brain. They're also what we tend to get addicted to. Now, what's the part that's aware? Well, there is a part of the brain called Pahabhasara Citta. In Sanskrit, it's called Prakti. Prabhasarachita, luminous mind. It's associated with Abhyangachita. In Buddhism, the Mahayana call it Bodhicitta, or Tathagatagarbha Bhagavata. In Dogchen thought, there's ideas of this too, but the idea is that there is a part of mind that operates below the level that strings consciousness together. That's why you don't go away when you go to sleep. You go to sleep and consciousness goes away, but you wake up and you're still the same person. You don't wake up and everything that you knew about yourself vanishes. So the luminous mind, Vangachitta, holds you together. And this is also the mechanism of rebirth, according to the Abhidharma in Buddhism. So you have luminous mind, and this is the part of mind that is perfected and purified when bodhicitta is attained, bodhicitta being enlightenment. This is purified, and it comes to the surface during enlightenment, according to some students of the Abhidharma. So, in the Anguttara Nikaya, Buddha states, luminous monks is the mind and is defiled by incoming defilements. These are the what happens when you see and hear things and you go and you like it. You get you desire these things. He indicates that the mind's natural radiance can be made manifest by meditation. So the mind is something more radiant than anything else can be, but these defilements obscure it, and it loses its radiance. The noise, the background noise of the senses, obscure the luminous mind. Sight, sound, taste, touch, these are also sensually rich, and so sensually pleasure, the sensual pleasure, are so distracting, the background noise hides the luminous mind, and that's what you purify in Buddhism. Next week we'll discuss more of this, purifying the mind and intention. We're going to do the stone of the week, which is citrine, and citrine, by the way, is a very good stone for helping you purify your mind. Citrine can be used against nightmares and night terrors, and citrine can be used for developing your psychic powers, spiritualism. You can remove fear, prevent nightmares, and it helps you sleep at night. It's a wonderful little stone. It's a form of quartz, it's yellowed because it has manganese and things like that in it. It's a healing stone. It's one of the healing stones, and it elevates your mood. If you want to elevate your mood, I recommend sunstone and citrine as stones to help elevate your mood. It helps bring self confidence. It helps renew your determination if you're feeling just kind of weak, down, dispirited. You need some oomph. Take your vitamins. Get protein. Help eat right. And don't do this nonsense about doing cleanses. By cleanses, I mean these things where you purge yourself. You drink all these cleanses. Your liver and your kidneys cleanse you. Just don't eat crap. Eat healthy food. Eat good vegetables. Don't eat junk food, and don't eat processed food. Eat good food and let your liver and your kidneys cleanse you. You don't have to do these cleanse diets and things. That's foolish. Just eat healthy for about a month, and your body, your kidneys and your liver will cleanse you for you. But the stones can help you elevate your energy. Sunstone and citrine is wonderful for this. And you wear them. You can press them close to your body. Great for chakra work if you do the chakra work. And citrine is a wonderful, wonderful tool for that. Do come back in 2 weeks for part two of this. Next week we'll have a replay because I have to go in for some follow-up surgery for the torn and ripped up tissues in my left shoulder. I have several muscles that are torn, and my arm just hangs there. I think if you gave me a firm handshake on my left hand, my arm would come off in my hand. So next week we're going to do a rebroadcast, and the week after that we'll do part two of Ghost in the Machine, more on consciousness and mind and identity. And I hope you've enjoyed this conversation as much as I have. I just find this very fascinating, to get to the root of existence itself. We'll talk more about Buddhism, and we'll look more into some of the physics of consciousness. I'm John St. Germain. This is the LMC Network. I do hope that you keep me in mind while I'm under the knife, and I'm certainly keeping you guys in mind. I love every one of you. Thanks for the support of the show. Good night, and God bless you.